This tape is for Eileen Hindy of Athabasca. The reason I am putting this on tape, it was my intention to call on you and discuss many things of the early days. However, I'm presently waiting to get into the hospital for an operation, so thought I would make this tape and send it to you. And if you have any further questions, in case I'm unable to drop in and see you, you can drop us a line to Oscar Green, 12707 123rd A Street, Edmonton, Alberta. Postal code is T5LOK6. We came to Athabasca Landing in 1911, before the railroad. We stood and watched them lay steel into Athabasca. And at that time, it was the only railroad to the north, and all the freight went through Athabasca, up the Athabasca to Lesser Slave Lake, and the steamboats run both up to Gruard, also down to the Grand Rapids. Because the Grand Rapids was impossible to go with the old steamboats. We took up a homestead, at least my father did, 3.5 miles south of Athabasca Landing. Which was adjoined on the south by a brickyard. We call this man Chili, but I know his name was spelt with a T. However, the bricks there were manufactured. He had a brickyard, and I believe the bricks were manufactured for the Hudson Bay store, which they built later on. I also remember the fire of Reverend Ferrier's and so forth. Our family used to play in Athabasca for dances. My father played the violin and the trumpet. My sister played the piano. My mother played the guitar, and I played the drums. Later on, they got a band together, and both my father and myself belonged to the band. In fact, 1 year the band bought and gave me a horn with the inscriptions on it to Oscar Green from the Athabasca Citizens Band. There was a clerk in the Grand Union Hotel also, Mr. Faulkner from the hardware store, were the band leaders in those days. They seemed to take turns. Leading the band at different times. I remember we played at the station when the boys went overseas, which they had trained in the old Hudson Bay warehouse. Which was just a block north and directly east of the Hudson Bay store and the Imperial Bank. When the war broke out, my father went back to the States. But my mother wouldn't go because my sister had married a mounted policeman by the name of Hugh Cochran, who was stationed at Druard after leaving Athabasca. He also joined up and went overseas, and my sister followed later, also went to England herself. However, I knew most of the old timers which at that time was Bill Day and his wife who were running the Grand Union Hotel. When Prohibition came in, they turned the bar into a restaurant. Also, there was only 3 cars in Athabasca at that time, of which Bill Day owned 2 of them, which were McLaughlin Buicks with carbide lamps, and you squeezed a bulb, a rubber bulb, to blow the horn. J.A. Daniel had one of the first Fords, cars, that was in Athabasca. Secondly, there was Scotty Willie, which I knew quite well, and everybody respected Scotty. He had a brother by the name of Al Willie, who also had a Ford car. But the first Ford cars used to get out of alignment and the steering would cramp. My mother was somewhat of a nurse, and there was only her and Dr. Myers that knew anything at all about medication and so forth. They opened up a kind of a hospital. It was either adjoined or above Faulkner's Hardware, but in the same building. Al Willie was going home late one night, and the road at that time to South Athabasca and out to Willie's had a turn across a strip of muskeg. Just about out in front of what was Bannerman's house at that time. Apparently, in making the turn to cross the strip, the steering had jackknifed on him and upset, and he laid all night. However long, we don't know, until somebody came along and found him underneath the car. He died shortly after that in this so-called hospital. It was also a man who was doing custom sawing of wood for various people who didn't have power saws. He somehow was transferring gas from a barrel, and he had a lantern that was at night, and the whole thing exploded, and he was brought in very badly burnt. He also died. I myself used to go to school in Athabasca. I don't remember, but believe it was a little log school on the street just east of the Grand Union Hotel and about three quarters of the way up the block. It was a very small place. I don't know if it's still there or not. I haven't been there lately. There was a man by the name of Ford who had a Ford car and used to take people from Athabasca out to South Athabasca to dances and so forth. this particular time, there was a road going from the brickyard west, I believe it was about a mile, and then it went south past some people by the name of Fisher's Place. Also, there was Underwoods that lived past the school. However, there was two ditches through the muskeg, one on each side, and the road wasn't very wide or very good. He somehow got one wheel over into the ditch, and Ernie Soper and myself were walking to the dance, so we helped him get out and rode to the dance with him. And he told us that if we would wait till he took his passengers all back, he would come and give us a ride. So when we got to where we should have got off, we were so interested in riding in a car that we rode all the way into Athabasca and then walked back home 3.5 miles. There was also Captain Haight and Captain Mills were both living at Athabasca Landing at that time, just up on the hill. They eventually built a new school up there, which I assume is still there. And we used to have a ballpark there. Harold Haight and myself were about the same age, and we used to go out and chase rabbits into the little wooden culverts at the head across the road. One would stay at one end, and the other person would get a stick and split it in the end and turn it around and get it in the fur of the rabbits and pull the rabbits out of the culvert. This is many long years ago. Then were some people started a boarding house by the name of La Branche. They lived up just at the foot of the hill going south, just beyond the ballpark. I became friends with one of the boys about a little older than myself. I knew the girls, and one of them, I believe it was Rosie La Branche, wanted to play her piano. I believe it was from the Edmonton Bulletin or Journal, I'm not sure, I don't remember. But going back to the band, I remember some of the people, there was about 25 of us playing in the band, and there was 3 or 4 Crawford boys. One of them's name was Julius, one was named Oscar, and the other, I believe, was named Ingram. I don't remember the names of any more of them. Then there was Sim Lewis and another Lewis boy, which right at the moment I forget his name, but I understand that he was in a home in Athabasca for a while. But I didn't know him that well. But there was Ray Lewis and myself and another boy we called Shorty Woods. And Forrest Day at that time was quite a boxer and had a gym down in the Grand Union Hotel in the basement. And we used to spar with him there in his training. Also, they put us young boys up boxing in the preliminaries. We came from Fayetteville, Arkansas in the spring of 1911 to Viking, Alberta. Where my father had accumulated 3 oxen and a covered wagon, and we drove from Viking to Athabasca Landing in the spring of 1911. I remember staying at Billy Smith's stopping place, which is, I believe, now known as Manuk. And there was bears roaming around, which scared the oxen as we had camped on a little creek. Billy Smith's had, I believe, the only thrashing machine in the district. And everybody had to wait their turn for him to come around in the fall and winter for this old steam thrashing outfit, which at first didn't have any rotating knives to cut the twine. So he had 2 men standing there with knives cutting the twine. Later they added to the separator rotating knives, which done away with that. However, it was quite a large outfit. And I think you had about 6 bundle wagons hauling to the thrashing machine. And of course, it was quite an event when the thrashers came. All the neighbors would join together and help thrash. And of course the women done the cooking. But it was just like a large family affair. Everybody knew everybody. So you really, it was more like a picnic when the thrashers came. One day while going to school in Athabasca, I used to ride into school on a bicycle. And going home, there was an old trail which went through the center of our homestead, you went up the first hill out south of Athabasca, and then you came to another ridge, and you went up that hill, and then it was level all the way to our homestead. However, there was a great big granite rock in the middle of the old trail. And as I came to this, there was a man, and I could see his hand was all blood. He had a knife in his hand, just looked like a pen knife, a small knife. Apparently he had cut his wrist. What we did at that time, have rural telephones, so my mother got on the phone and phoned the mounted police in Athabasca, of which my brother-in-law was one of them at that time, Hugh Coughlin. And they sent two men out. They finally located the man and took him into town and put him in the hospital, which was in the west upon the hill, about halfway up to where they built a reservoir for water later on. This hospital burnt down after that, but they had me come in and identify the man. I had a dog, and also I kept my brother-in-law's dog, which was an Airedale, and my sister, after her husband enlisted, came from Guard and was living in Athabasca. And I had trained these two dogs to pull a sleigh. So they sent me down, which was only a block or two, to pick up the groceries and bring them up. However, there was a loose dog, which I believe was just a young pup. And he followed us home to my sister's house. Much to my surprise, I never did know, but apparently someone noticed this dog. He stuck around with the other dogs, and when my sister would feed the dogs, of course he was there, so he stayed there. He must have belonged to some farmer or somebody who had come to town. Anyway, they picked up the dog, but much to my surprise, here sometime between the 50s and 60s, I had been helping Bradstreet and Dunn's, giving out information and credit risks and so forth. They would phone me up, as I was in business here in Calder and Edmonton. And they used me and the grocery store, which was run by a man by the name of Barbo, to gather information. So one day he asked me if there was anything he could do for me. I said, yeah, see what they got down on my record. And much to my surprise, they had it down that I had stole this dog. Of which I had nothing to do with. The dog merely followed me home. And when my sister fed the other dogs, well, of course, he was there and he got some of the food too. But nobody was trying to keep him or anything. And they never told me or asked me any questions about it. But just put down, I suppose, to get rid of it, they put down that I had stole the dog. You can imagine how I felt so many years later that I had stole a dog when I was just about 12, 13 years old. Also, I didn't know, I was too young to know, but I used to go fishing down where they were building scows. And my line went underneath one of the scows and got hooked onto something which I didn't know what it was, but it turned out to be a string. And somebody had got smart enough to put a string underneath the scows, which were out in the water, and tie bottles of whiskey onto them. I think they put them into socks or something like that. Anyway, while fishing there, my line got tangled up under the scow of the water. It switched it out and got hooked on. As it wasn't very deep, I waded in, and when I pulled on the line, I could see a sock with a bottle in it hooked on this line under the scow. So I told my brother-in-law about it, but I never heard what happened. But I would imagine they confiscated the liquor they found. Prior to that, I had seen them have them unload these scows, trying to find some liquor that was getting north. I didn't know at that time that there was no liquor allowed on the north side of the river. But there was no restrictions in the town of Athabasca itself. I found out all this later on. Also, I worked for Nye Brothers. I believe it would be about 1915. Nye Brothers used to ship coal in and haul it with a team of horses and sleigh and wagon in the summertime. They had a weigh scale just up off the river a ways, where they later, I think, built some elevators in there. There also used to be a sawmill there. And there was a man by the name of Dent that run it for a while. Anyway, I answered the phone and weighed coal, which I got $8 a month. I also worked for a while for Johnson's Bakery, delivering bread around town. Then I got a job in the hotel as a night clerk. I was supposed to call the railroad crew and also about 4:30 in the morning or something like that. Also supposed to call Bilsmeyer, who was running the restaurant. However, Bilsmeyer had his own alarm clock, But I was very interested in mechanics. And Bill Day had a man who was working on mostly boat motors. I used to go down and help him a little, which mostly I was washing parts for him or something. But I'd go down there in the daytime, but I'd done too much of this. So one night, I thought there was an empty room. I would just go and lay down for a little while. I was so tired. I'd done all my work as I was supposed to do, which included keeping the furnace going and so forth. Anyway, I went to sleep. About 9 o'clock, Archambault came up, the day clerk, woke me up and told me to go have breakfast. And when I come out from having breakfast, he said, "Everything's okay." He said, "Vilsmaar woke up and he called him because he knew what room he was in. And in turn, they called the railway crew. But they had a check made out, so he passed it across the counter to me and said, "I guess you're fired." Then I got a job with J.A. Daniel in the livery barn. And there was a little room there just off the office. I slept there at night. But the reason of having me there was that people would come late at night either to put their teams in or to take them out. And Daniel also had a crushing mill in the livery barn where people would bring grain in and get it crushed and take it home. He also had a two-wheeled water cart. And I had the job of delivering water and taking it out of this two-wheeled tank and putting it into barrels for people that didn't have any running water in the outlying district. By this time, of course, they had built this reservoir, and the people in the heart of Athabasca all mostly had running water. However, about 1917, I think it was, I was coming down after delivering water, and I didn't know I was sick. But everybody there were dying with the flu. And the undertaker had come and asked me to come and give him a hand. I went only once, and I never went back. However, I must have caught the flu because I was just passing the Imperial Bank, and I think it was Sim Lewis, who was working in the bank at the time. He later joined the army. But anyway, I fell off this cart on my head, and somebody took me back to the barn, and I woke up there. I didn't know anything about what had happened. Then they took me home And at that time, we lived up on just west of the baseball diamond, which is just south of the Imperial Bank. And my mother nursed me back into good health. So I went back and worked for Daniel for a while. And my mother had an ice cream parlor. Somebody talked her into opening a little restaurant just a block east of the Grand Union Hotel, just a small place. So she did. Well, then she needed me to wait on tables. Whenever she would get sick, it turned out that I was the cook and the waiter both. And we had the railroad crew every morning for breakfast. However, I fried bacon and eggs and made hotcakes. And I'd go to my mother to find out how to mix up the dough for the hotcakes. Later on, I got a job out at Long Lake, what was known as Doc Berry's Sawmill. And they wanted a cook there, asked me if I knew of anybody, so I asked my mother. And she was just barely getting by in this restaurant, so she closed the restaurant and came out to the sawmill. So we both worked in the sawmill. She done the cooking, and I helped her. Then the sawmill went broke. We had quite a job. I finally got a few dollars, but I had to come to Edmonton to do so. Anyway, I come in to Athabasca after the sawmill went broke, and I got a job helping Captain Alexandra get the old Slave River steamboat ready to take it to Fort McMurray. And the first year they couldn't go because the water was too low. But we did go in 1919 and went through the Grand Rapids at 7 o'clock in the morning. I believe it was May the 23rd or 24th, 1919. Of course, we hit about three rocks. Joe Bird was the pilot. And I don't remember the names of the other. But it turned out that I helped the captain plug the holes in the bottom of the steamboat. As more water was coming in than the pumps and siphon could take out. So we were tied up in an eddy at the bottom of Grand Rapids. So we went on to Fort McMurray. Then on to Fitzgerald, up to Vermilion Chutes, and so forth. I was transferred to the SS distributor. And help put the machinery in. And worked on that boat. Until the fall. Of which I volunteered along with another Athabasca boy to take the mail to Fort Norman. Now I'll go back to Athabasca Landing while I was clerk in the Grand Union. I can't remember the date, but there was an election on. And Bill Day apparently was the returning officer. And he had gone out to where the pole was, which was up the east hill and south. He was returning to Athabasca with a ballot box, and this McLaughlin Buick Roadster, of which he was driving, stopped on him. And I was the only one left in Athabasca Landing. I was at the livery barn. At the time, I see this horse come running down the east hill, which I thought was kind of funny because it was too steep to gallop a horse downhill. Anyway, he came up to the livery barn and said that the car had stopped on Bill Day, and as he had the ballot box and he couldn't leave, and he wanted me to come out and see if I could get the car going. So I asked him if I could borrow his horse. No, and there was no other horses in town, and there was no other people in town. So I had to walk up the east hill and about 4 miles or so south to where the car was stalled. However, the cars in those days didn't have a battery or a starter or anything like that. You had to crank them. So the hood was held down with a leather strap from one side to the other. I took the strap off, lifted part of the hood up, and I saw a hole in the distributor cap, and I saw a wire. But I didn't know very much about it anyway. I shoved this wire into the hole, took the crank and gave it a flip, and the car went. So I rode back with Bill Day. Everything was fine. Also, I forgot to mention that Nellie McClung, I believe it was staying in the hotel as she was lectioneering along with some of the others. It must have been around 1916 or 17 or something like that. Possibly it was 1915. Anyway, she couldn't lock her door from the inside, so I had to go up and lock it from the outside and pass the key to her from the inside and wait and see if she could unlock it from the inside, which she could. So that was that. Later, I had been transferred to South Athabasca, where they had built a school. There was other teachers, but I remember a Mrs. Sawyer. And she had two daughters, but I particularly remember the one whose name was Jean. She was about my age. And at Christmas time, she always put me with Jean, and we had to sing a song. I used to ride a pony to school part of the time, and I used to stop and Madge Fisher would get on the pony in the saddle and ride to school, and I would ride behind. I particularly remember Judd Underwood, and Kenny Menz. I believe Kenny was an adopted boy, but we called him Kenny Menz, as he lived with the Menz family. We had a picnic out at a creek near the Willys, which was known as Muskeg Creek. And there was a kind of a falls and a pool, which is deep in one end and sandy in the other. And Kenny had got out in the deep water and couldn't get ashore. But there was a lot of grown-up men there. So I hollered to the men. They were all standing up to get their picture taken. And I hollered that Kenny was drowning. The men, of course, could wade right in and stand up, but us little fellas wasn't tall enough. So they jumped in to get Kenny, and of course I foolishly jumped in too. And they got Kenny out and got him on the bank, but they forgot about me. I could just get my toes in the sand, but there was a kind of backflow of water, and I had an awful job to get out, but I finally did get out. But I almost drowned myself. Sometime about 1914 or 1915, my mother sold our homestead to Warren Richards. Betty Vilsmaier, that used to wait tables in the Vilsmaier Cafe in the old Grand Union, had married Todd Richards, who lived across the river north of the town of Athabasca. I remember the two large, red-headed policemen that they had in Athabasca. And in fact, when they were building the Alaska Highway, we first went through Athabasca Landing and on up through Slave Lake and so forth to Dawson Creek. I had two trucks hauling freight from Edmonton to Dawson Creek. One of the drivers told me that it was no good, it was too tough. So I took a notion to go myself and try and see what it was like. But the man driving the other truck had forgotten put a wheel wrench in for his truck, and he had a flat tire before we got to Athabasca. So we stopped there, and here's this one of these policemen that used to be policeman there, and he was policeman there during that period of time. So I asked him where the man lived that run the garage. He asked me what I wanted. I told him I wanted a wheel wrench. He says, you get a hold of McKenzie, he'll get you a wheel wrench. Well, I had known McKenzie for years before. In fact, as a kid, I used to gather up bottles and old rubber boots and stuff from the Revion fire and ship them to Edmonton along with bottles and so forth, which were laying all over the bushes, and I made a few dollars. I don't remember how it ended up, but we finally got a wrench someplace, changed the tire, and went on our way up north. Something happens between Bill Day and his wife. And Bill Day went north. Nobody ever heard from him that I knew of. But one day at a Klavik, before they moved the town, and now call it Inuvik, we used to go there with the distributor, and somebody brought word up that there was a man wanted to see me and pointed out the schooner where he was. So I went down. And here was Bill Day. And he introduced me and said that was his wife, which was an Eskimo woman. So I suppose they must have got separation or something. That's the first time and the last time that I ever saw him. After he left Athabasca. Prior to that, when Bill Day was still at the hotel, I had got a job herding cows for Fisher Brothers, who had a small log house just before you got to Baptiste Lake, going straight west. Fisher Brothers were from Montana, and I'm not sure what happened, but there was something wrong because the mounted police came out and all at once the Fisher Brothers moved out, and they were associated somehow with Bill Day and I don't know who else. I would assume that there was some rustling going on or something, because I went into town and they were all there, including Bill Day, and everything went flop. This could have been part of the reason why he went north. But I have no way of knowing, so really shouldn't be saying so. but definitely was something wrong. I saw Sim Lewis sometime in the 30s. He was a telephone operator in Athabasca. And I was walking by, I didn't know that he was in the telephone office. And he spotted me and stopped me. So I went in and talked to him for a little while. And I think his father and mother were transferred to Fort Simpson to work with the Indian agent there and run a sawmill. However, I was in to Fort Simpson several times, but always we only stopped a few minutes. So I never got a chance to look around or to look them up. My oldest sister died out at Vancouver several years back. And my sister, Betty, is living out near Baptiste Lake. I believe you know her or know of her. Her married name is Betty Gibbons. Our homestead was just a half a mile west of the last road used by the freighters. And you could hear the sleighs and the cold weather and the bells that they had on the horses. When talking about lectioneering and that, I had forgot the name of the place where the voting was taking place, but it was at Shank's place. Was on the road south and east of Athabasca and up the East Hill. I don't know who it was, but someone had a Ford car and they put tractor wheels on this Ford. Excuse me, I'm having a little trouble with this recorder. They put tractor wheels on this Ford car, which was about the normal size of tractor wheels, and they put little wheels on the axle, which rotated the big wheels, and they were able to plow with it. This was on the right-hand side going east up the East Hill, but I don't remember the name of the person who owned it. But both my mother and myself worked at the experimental farm, which was to the left on top of the East Hill. And there was quite a few coyotes around. And the manager had a double-barrel shotgun. And they were coming up around the corral, and there were some calves there. So I took this double-barrel shotgun, and as there were board fences around the corral, I climbed up on top of the board fence and I jumped down into the corral. But the hammers on this shotgun was on the outside And I had turned it upside down, and when I jumped over, I tripped both of the hammers, and the gun went off in my hand. Very lucky for me. That I didn't get hurt. Also, one of the Shanks used to do quite a bit of boxing. In fact, there was very few, if any, could outdo the Shanks boy. I think his name was Philip. In a rough and tumble fight. But he had no training, or very little, as a boxer. Although I never saw him do it, it was said that he could drive a spike through a 2x4 with his bare hand, which I would still have to see to believe. It was also a colored man, or they call him black today, that had a blacksmith shop just across the alley east of the hotel, Grand Union Hotel. I think his name was Lipscomb. I also worked for the Hudson Bay store when Mackey worked there. Later on, Mackey took over Renison's store. I believe that Mr. Renison died with TB. Anyway, Mackey took over his store and run it. He was the accountant and clerk at the Hudson Bay store. The manager at that time was Mackay. I mentioned before that we played the boys off when they went overseas. We also got the band together and played when they come back. But I think that was just about the end of the band. I don't remember after that. I know that Julius Crawford became a salesman, I believe, for Scott Fruit. And what became of the rest of them, I don't know. But as the war had taken the majority, the band had to be discontinued. But Mr. Faulkner, F.R. Faulkner, he'd got enough of us together to play when the boys came home. But in the early days, before Prohibition, Athabasca was quite a rough place, with nothing to see. People getting thrown out of the bar, and so forth, and lots of fights. In fact, there used to be 4 or 5 or more mounted policemen stationed there. I remember they built a hotel west of the Grand Union. It was built of brick veneer, and apparently there was a creek that run down through the middle of it, and when it came spring, I guess the cement cracked and I don't think the hotel was ever opened. They had a fairgrounds south of town where they used to have fairs with rodeos and so forth. Someone owned a couple of racehorses, and Bill Day had a horse they called Dick Sailor. Also, Mr. Spence, I'm not sure of his first name, but seems to me it was George Spence, had a black farm horse, a great big hoofs, but he could run, outrun almost anything that they had. However, they couldn't get a rider that could get him back to go past the gate where he went in. Mr. Spence got me to ride him when riding him before the races. I seemed to be able to get him to go past this gate without going out. However, when the race was on, I was leading the race, but this horse took a notion to go through the gate. I pulled his head right around and hit him with a stick and everything, but he went sideways right over the top of the gate with me on him. So it was just impossible to get him to stay on the track. I believe it was Bill Day that owned Dick Sailor, also had a horse they called the Bay Mare. It would seem that they took turns of winning against two regular racehorses that a man and his son had there, and the son used to ride him. It seemed Dick Sailor would win one race and lose the next. They had a little table laid out where people were betting on the outcome of the races. So they put me on Dick Sailor, but they didn't give me a whip or anything. And I'd watched other boys ride him, and you had to touch him a little bit with the whip to get him to come down the home stretch and win. So I went around underneath a tree that was by the barns and broke off a small limb. And I came onto the racetrack with this limb in my hand. But Bill Day come up and grabbed it out of my hand and said, "You don't need a whip on that horse." So I had to go on and ride him without a whip. And of course I lost. But I'm only guessing that this is what they wanted, as I was a little heavier than the boys who had been riding the same horse. I think the actual money was made where they bet on the outcome of the races. If I remember correctly, they held these races about two or three times a year. There was also a fur buyer that lived in Athabasca. I believe his name was Hingley. It used to buy fur from the trappers and Indians who came into Athabasca. I am not sure of this name, but I think his name was George Hess, who opened up a butcher shop down around Renaissance Store. As I said before, which was taken over later by a Mr. Mackey, who was former bookkeeper for the Hudson Bay Company. As I mentioned before, we took the old slave river steamboat down through the Grand Rapids and through all the other rapids, to Cascade, Boiler Rapids, Wrigley Rapids, and so forth. And when we got to McMurray, I went up to see Angus Sutherland, who was running a drugstore. He was formerly worked for Mr. Call in the drugstore at Athabasca, and I knew him a little bit. He was a good friend of my father's. But when the railway got into Fort McMurray, that practically killed Athabasca as a shipping point north. Everybody went by train to Fort McMurray, although the railroad stopped about 4 miles south of what was called Waterways. We used to get a ride on a speedster sometimes with Mickey Ryan into Waterways, which was the end of the steel. But as it was laid on tar sands going down the hill, the trains didn't go in that far, and everything was taken into Waterways by wagon or on speeders on the railroad track. Although I was just a young fella at that time, I knew most of the people in the surrounding district because of working in the hotel and working for J.A. Daniels Livery Barn. Most farmers in the district didn't have crushers and used to bring grain in to Daniels to get it ground. Or they put their horses in the barn, livery barn, and that's how I became acquainted with them. I could go on and on giving you names of people that I knew around Athabasca, but I don't think would be of any use to you. If there's anything on this tape that you can use, you are free to do so. Whatever you don't use doesn't matter. I don't know exactly what you need, but if you will drop a line to me in Edmonton, or if I get a chance, I will drop in and see you at Athabasca and give you any further information that might be of some help to you. hoping you find a few things of interest that you can use. We'll be glad to meet you sometime in the near future. But as I am now 86 years old last March, and who knows, I may live many long years and I may not. So it's good luck to you in doing what you're doing, and hope you find a few things that will help. Yours truly, Oscar A. Green. You are free to use this, any of this, in any form you wish.